Hello and welcome to the Local Economic Development Podcast.
Hosted by Sean Cunningham
and Jörg Meyer-Starmer.
For other programs in this series, please take a look at www.ledcast.net.
Hi, Sean.
Hi, Jörg. What are we talking about today?
Value chains. Maybe you just want to highlight why that idea struck us.
Jörg, other than that we get so many questions about value chains the whole time and that we do training on this so often, it is a topic that for the last couple of years have been really important in literature and in the development field.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we thought of maybe spending 2 or 3 shows on this and to have a series just on value chains.
Okay.
So that we can cover the theory and some of the practical aspects of value chain assessment.
Right. Great.
So, Jörg, what is a value chain?
Well, it's usually defined as the whole sequence of activities involved in transforming a given product. So running from the clay to the finished ceramic tile, or running from the field to the ready-to-cook set of vegetables on the shelf of a supermarket. So all the different steps involved in transforming, in manufacturing and processing things, plus all the services that are related to that.
And then how is this different from a supply chain?
Yeah, that's a good question, eh? I was always wondering about that. My favorite answer is that it's not at all different, really. But what is behind it is a rather different body of literature and different academic disciplines. When you look at the literature on value chains, it's mostly sociologists and to some extent economists who have been driving this, mostly development economists. Whereas the supply chain literature, well, that's something that comes from business schools and from engineering faculties.
Okay, so basically with a value chain, we look up the chain from the one angle, and with a supply chain perspective, one's looking at it from pretty much the other angle.
Yeah, but then again, also maybe not. I mean, when I have to explain what value chains is all about, one of my favorite questions is, okay, so how do you move a chain, any chain? And the answer, of course, is the only way to move it is by pulling it. You can't push a chain. It just doesn't work physically.
Yes.
And that is, I think, one of the important elements, one of the important aspects about this whole discussion, that it introduces a very, very strong end market, final customer perspective. So in the old days, we often were involved in activities where we tried to strengthen some producer somewhere, and then we hoped that once we had upgraded them, somebody would just be keen and willing to buy their products. And nowadays we know that it's often much smarter to start at the other end and to look at the needs of customers and the demands of retailers and to work our way back from the final stages.
I think maybe another difference between a supply chain and a value chain is that large retailers or tier one or two manufacturers very often manage their supply chains very, very carefully.
Yeah.
Where many other products simply move through these steps in a chain without the whole chain being managed very carefully. So I think that's maybe another difference in the two approaches.
While at the same time there is a strong overlap, because when you look at the value chain literature and where it comes from, I mean, the whole value chain discussion, I think, started with a book that came out in 1994. It was edited by two American sociologists, Gary Jaraffe and Miguel Kochinevitz. And what they were looking at was production systems like the one of Nike. You know, Nike, this sneaker manufacturer from the US, which doesn't have any factories. Nike is one of the biggest sneaker brands in this world, but they don't manufacture anything themselves. It's all subcontracted to producers, mostly in East and Southeast Asia. And when people looked at that, they found that there were quite a few settings, quite a few systems like that one, where you had one lead company, which in some cases was, a branding company. In some other cases, it was a retail company. And they were actually actively managing hundreds, if not thousands, of producers all over the world in some cases. Like IKEA, the the European, originally Swedish furniture retailer, they've always had thousands of manufacturers anywhere in between Sweden and Vietnam. And that was what the early literature was all about.
Well, actually, the first publication with the word supply chain management was published already as far ago as 1954 by the Harvard Business School.
Yeah.
And then what's also interesting is that in French research institutes, a very similar approach, obviously they didn't use the word supply chain or value chain, it's been developed since the 1960s. That was also focused on chains.
The filière, yeah. But then again, that had a slightly different angle because the filière was only to some extent looking at analyzing and describing reality. It was also to a very strong extent aiming at trying to design economic systems. So if you want to develop an economic system, what is the chain of activities and the productive systems that you have to set up? So filière again comes from a different background and has a different intention than either supply chain management or the value chain approach that we are seeing these days.
Yes, no, I agree with you on that. But what is interesting is that some of the recent literature, like the Gemini publication on subsector analysis, was largely influenced by the French approach.
It was an evolution from that.
Yes, so they turned it into a more usable, action-orientated methodology.
Yeah. So maybe let's look at it from that angle now. It has evolved from an approach that originally had academic roots, was very much informed by academic perspectives, and was driven by the academic interest in describing the real world in a more adequate way. And then it jumped across into the development field, and development practitioners picked it up and said, all right, now if we can describe the world in a more adequate way, maybe we can then also actively develop it in a more promising way.
Yeah, so since the 90s, there's been active interests by the likes of USAID and GTZ and many other donors and smaller development consultancies in developing manuals and methodologies that all looked at value chains and how it can be analyzed and how you can intervene into value chains.
Right.
And at a conference in May this year, we counted more than 32 different manuals on value chains. So there's certainly a lot of literature on this nowadays. But I think what is interesting is that a lot of the earlier literature for the development field has been in agricultural development and rural development, and not so much in the more manufacturing sector or in more advanced sectors of the economy.
Yeah. That is one of the distinctive features of the practitioner's approach, because when you look at the academic approach, that was, well, to some extent about furniture or garments, because that were some of the big and important international or other global value chains that people detected in the 1990s. But it was also about like computers and cars, so highly complex industrial products that involved a multitude of different elements, of different components, like in the case of a car, more than 10,000 different elements. So that when you try to fully map that value chain, if you try to fully describe the value chain, you're probably going to be busy for the rest of your life. Whereas it's obviously much easier in a case like, well, say fresh vegetables or fresh fruit, where much less processing is involved and where you have a much more straightforward value chain. And maybe it's one of the interesting features to see that there is kind of a polarization between academia and practice, in that academia is looking at rather sophisticated value chains. Academic research has often been driven by the normative idea of moving from the low road to the high road, moving from, well, exploitative labor relations and relatively unproductive production systems to high value added, more sophisticated production systems that offer a higher development potential and also much better wages and working conditions. So they are pretty much looking at the high end, very sophisticated retailers and relatively sophisticated producers, Whereas our colleagues in the agriculture field and the rural development field are often working with very poor producers, which is kind of the opposite side of the spectrum.
I think there's maybe another reason, and that is so little data really exists on what's happening in the rural areas that academics would probably just not find this feasible, where you can analyze statistics and all kinds of other sources and do a very interesting value chain study without even leaving your office if you choose the right sector.
Yeah. Okay.
But maybe we should look at value chain development and territorial development.
Yes.
Maybe you should first explain what do we mean with territorial development.
Yeah, well, we are using this term territorial development increasingly because we are not always happy with the kind of connotation that we get, say, with local economic development, because so many people see local economic development as, well, small poverty alleviation projects, small self-help projects. Whereas territorial development as a term has its background in the European discussion, especially around EU structural policy, EU regional policy, where we have been talking about territorial development for quite some time. And also bridges this problem that we often have to say, okay, what is local economic development? What is regional economic development? Is there any clear boundary between these things? And we now say, well, let's not waste time talking about that. Let's just talk about territories, which is something that is much less than a country and also often much less than a province in a country. And let's cover that with the term territorial development.
I think another important aspect of territory is that territorial development, the region is always seen as part of a much bigger whole, where in local economic development, people sometimes forget about the bigger world and they just focus on micro projects. And maybe that is the first reason why value chains is so important in territorial development.
That's true.
Because it connects your territory locally with regional and international global markets.
Mm, right. And that's probably the first and the most important reason why the value chain discussion is so important for territorial development. If you are not aware of the way your local producers interact with the bigger market, and especially, well, not with an abstract and anonymous market, but rather with big retailers at a national level or even internationally, then you probably can't do your local economic development in a very effective way.
So I think you've also just touched on a second point, and that is that so often value chain promotion is limited to a local or regional level, and that is too small, it's too weak, and the scale is so small.
Sorry for interrupting. Sometimes it does make sense. I mean, we've seen occasions where we actually had kind of a value chain that did exist at a regional level, and that would include cases like, well, herbs, where you have collectors of herbs at a local level, and then some initial processing going on within your region, and then the proper industrial processing going on, and the wrapped, the packaged product coming out, so that actually you do have quite a few steps of the value chain within your territory. Or in other cases, I've seen that, say, in textile and garment industries, where you had a lot of the steps of a value chain within a given location or a given region. But of course, you're right. I mean, in many other cases, there's only very few steps of a given value chain that are actually located within your territory.
Okay, so basically there's then local and regional and national and global value chains.
Yeah.
But I think the point is that when you try to construct or try to analyze, promote a local value chain, you still have to understand how the broader value chains work.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because you also always have to be ready that your local value chain could eventually compete with a global value chain that's penetrating to your territory, that's reaching into your territory. So, you know, I think the important point just is that you have to look at the different regions and understand the chains.
Yeah.
I think from a territorial development perspective, what we are often confronted by is that when we go to rural areas, because so much of our work is in the rural areas, we are very often confronted by the weakest links in the chain.
Yeah.
And
or even worse, we are confronted with people who are not nowhere connected to any chain at all.
Yes. My favorite example, we have goats or goat farmers. Hardly any commercial activity. There's also no scale in their activity, so they are pretty much informal goat farmers.
Or more like goat observers, actually. Because they observe the goats that are roaming free in their place.
And that is very often where a donor would say, we want a goat value chain. Okay. So let's maybe wrap up this discussion by just summarizing that value chains, the term value chains apply to very simple agricultural or commodity products. And the value chain concept and many of the methodologies can then also be scaled and applied to industrial products and even to sectors like tourism, which is largely a service sector. So value chains, we don't just mean potatoes or chickens or goats. Yeah. We could also mean automotive or pharmaceutical or tourism or other sectors.
Right. Except that with automotive, we wouldn't want to address the entire value chain. We would have to be very selective in the elements that we want to work with.
But that is actually relevant to many other simpler chains as well.
You know, that's also true.
You know, if you think of the furniture value chain, then you have to say, what kind of furniture? Are we talking of wood?
That's a very complex value chain. That's true.
And then we say, let's look at wood, and then do we start... Yeah. Where do we start our chain? So I think that the point is that the methodologies are very similar. It's actually just how deep and how detailed your analysis would be that would differ.
Yeah.
Once you've specified which part of the chain or which chain specifically you are looking at.
Yeah. So the way our discussion is going now, we are saying that there's not only the element of analyzing how your local producers are connected to global value chains in order to see whether upgrading makes sense at all or what kind of upgrading you want to do, but we also sometimes try to work really with a value chain as a chain, that is, with different elements, with different players that are involved in different steps of a given value chain, isn't it?
Yes, and what we have learned from painful experience is that you cannot really fix the chain if the actors in the chain are not aware of the problems and are not very eager to address them themselves.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, that kind of takes us back to one of the things you said earlier. In some cases, you have a lead company in a given value chain or rather supply chain that is managing its supply chain. Whereas in other cases, if you analyze it, you find that there is a chain and different types of processing going on along the chain, but the players inside the chain are not necessarily aware of the whole structure. And there's nobody who's looking at the entire value chain and trying to understand the bottlenecks, but maybe also the opportunities that exist in terms of developing and upgrading that value chain.
And in those kind of chains that you've just explained, information about market requirements or pricing or legal changes really don't flow very well between the different links in the chain.
Yes, yeah.
So you find that most relationships are really informal or very distant, or the clever people call it spot relationships or spot transactions. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's also ongoing interactions, but people don't really like each other because each time they have to negotiate about the next order and about the price and the conditions for the next order, it's haggling and fighting all over again. So what I've often observed is that in a given value chain, everybody just about hates everybody else, or at least those people they are, those businesses they are directly interacting with.
Maybe what we should do is take a look at some of the typical approaches to value chain promotion.
Okay.
So I think the first one and the most obvious one is the one where you go into a very comprehensive study on a value chain.
Mm. And not just one, but dozens of value chains.
Yes. And then maybe out of this, picking a chain that you want to analyze even deeper.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's maybe the one approach.
Yeah. That is something that we've often seen donor agencies doing and has a lot to do with internal structures of donor agencies where you have to justify really well why you are doing this and not doing that. So there's kind of an implicit incentive to do very comprehensive research because before you take any decision in terms of what exactly you're going to do.
I think there's a second group of people that really like this, and that would be your government departments and agencies that's trying to assess policies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they would also very often do a very deep and very thorough analysis.
Yeah.
And what is quite ironic is that very often the actors in that value chain won't even know that they are being studied.
Yeah, right.
Or they would know they're being studied, but they would never really see the results.
Yeah, or the point in that whole study. Well, coming from a similar angle, but using a slightly different approach, is something that we've also seen quite a few times, where you do kind of a rapid assessment of maybe one value chain, maybe a few value chains. And then based on that rapid assessment, you decide which value chain is the most promising one or the most interested one in engaging with you and becoming active in some developmental effort.
I think there's a third approach, and that is where you are sent to a place to do a LED assessment or something, mm-hmm. and you simply discover actors, and then you discover that they are connected in a chain.
Yeah.
So maybe that is the third approach, which is the assess the chain by accident approach. You find certain actors, and then you realize that they should be connected in a way, and then you start your assessment from there.
Yeah, right.
And municipal officials and NGOs are very often involved in that kind of development as well.
Mm, yeah.
Yet another approach is where you find lead firms in the economy or in the territory that you're working with, or lead buyers.
Mm.
And then you figure out with them which value chains or which of their supply chains would offer big development opportunities.
Yeah. It's something that we have seen not so often, but those people who have approached value chain development in that way, I think they've got very, very good results, because when you look into a given value chain, you often find that a major buyer, the company that is the most powerful one inside that value chain, they are really calling the shots, and every business is looking at them. And if they say, look, you know, please work with these guys, and it's an interesting initiative, and it's going to help all of us to upgrade and become more competitive, then the businesses along the value chain will be quite keen to work with you. Whereas I recall, for instance, an experience we had in Brazil a couple of years ago, where we tried to engage with dairy farmers and processors inside a dairy value chain. But they were only looking at a major dairy company, and we couldn't engage with them. They weren't really interested. And ultimately, we had to discontinue our initiative because the producers just were not interested in working with us.
I think one of the other reasons why this approach of going to the lead firms or the lead buyers is not so popular with so many development practitioners is because development practitioners are very often biased towards SMEs or rural farmers.
Yeah.
And they tend to shy away from large firms or powerful firms.
Mm.
And I've had so many instances where development agencies just won't allow you to work with the big firms because they would say, yes, but we're an SME project.
Right, yeah, exactly. And they're quite right, because they might really get in trouble with their masters when all of a sudden they detect that they are interacting with some major corporation.
Yes, and I think there's also a fear that the major corporation would somehow just become more powerful and more profitable.
Yeah.
But it's ironic, because we've seen so many examples where one retailer can actually change the life of 1,000 organic farmers that are too small or too under-equipped to compete in any other market. Mm. And, you know, so I think, but I do think that the times are changing, and that more and more, even rural and agricultural development projects are reaching out to lead firms or to important firms.
Yeah, it's just so obvious that they have a huge potential in leveraging resources for economic development.
I think there's maybe two more approaches that one can describe very fast. The one approach is where donors or a local government or a provincial government wants to create employment opportunities, and they say, let's find a sector or a chain where there's opportunities.
Yeah.
That's the one approach, and I've been involved in one case where we decided to choose two chains based on criteria about employment, labor absorption, employment of women.
Mm.
And the one chain really worked well, and the other chain completely failed. Mm. And I'm not sure, you know, what we did wrong there. But maybe another approach is, and this is a very popular approach, is where you pick some producers, and then you try to push them to the market.
and into a chain, the wishful thinking approach.
It's the wishful thinking approach. It's sometimes the approach that is really pushed by politics or social dynamics. Very often these kind of chain development activities do not yield desirable results. These farmers are typically disillusioned or upset, or the moment the government support runs out, they just go back to what they've done before.
Yeah. It's often effectively an incarnation of the attempt to try to push a chain. And as we said before, pushing a chain just doesn't work.
So, Jörg, what are the critical success factors of value chain promotion?
Well, I think we've pretty much covered some of them. I think one of the most important ones is to really analyze the power structure inside a value chain. And if you find that there is a strong center of power inside that chain, which often will be a big retailer, then you really want to engage with them. Because if you don't have them on your side, if they don't support your initiative, then you're not going to get anywhere. Things are different when you're inside a value chain where you don't have this strong power center, but they are getting increasingly rare these days.
But, you know, I don't think that the power structure only refers to bullies. Mm. I think the power structure could also refer to trendsetters or the leaders.
Yeah, no, I'm not.
So, no, I just want to make sure that our listeners understand that power structure could be positive and power structure could also be negative.
Absolutely. Yeah, I fully agree. I mean, it's typically both things. It's always this dialectical thing. There is the powerful player who is competing in their own market and under a hell of a pressure, so they are putting pressure onto their suppliers as well. But at the same time, they are coming up with innovative retail concepts. They are coming up with new ways of exploiting market opportunities and are creating new opportunities for everybody involved in their supply chain as well.
So I think another critical success factor is to look at these powerful buyers in the chain and to engage with them.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we can typically not compete with them.
Yeah.
In many cases.
Right. And also, from a practical perspective, what we've often found is that when you engage with them and you say, so we have a background in rural development, or we have a background in regional development or something, they say, oh, please let me show you to our corporate social responsibility guys. And then you have to say, no, that's not at all what we want. We want to talk to your procurement managers. We want to engage with your procurement managers. We don't want to have some sponsoring activity. We want to have a proper business relationship with you.
And then you have already discussed the importance of understanding that one can only pull a chain.
Yeah.
I would like to add a fourth one, because you and I'm certainly biased, and we should tell our listeners about this, and that is that we believe that the chain actors should participate in the analysis.
Mm, that's right, yeah.
And that it doesn't actually help if you and I better understand the chain. It's really more important that the actors in the chain understand the chain.
Yeah, right.
And so maybe just to explain that, we really feel that important approach is the participation approach.
Yeah. Which is sometimes quite different from what some organizations are doing, who are sending in consultants, who are sending in researchers to do very comprehensive studies of a given value chain. Whereas what we would prefer is to have, well, to some extent interviews, but then relatively quick and efficient workshops with different groups of stakeholders from inside a value chain, where we are doing mapping exercises of that value chain with the stakeholders, so that we learn what is happening inside that chain, but typically also they then start to understand much better what is happening inside their chain, because they don't know all the elements, they don't know all the games that are being played inside their value chain, so that that kind of workshop is very insightful for everybody and often takes you quite directly to identifying opportunities for action.
And, you know, I've had people say, but these participatory approaches are too insignificant and too small. Mm. But what we've seen so often is that a whole portfolio of activities are launched, dealing with information flows and relationships and everything.
Yeah.
But also, I've seen so many instances where even policy recommendations can come out of that.
Absolutely.
Out of that assessment.
Yes.
So, you know, you don't necessarily have to do a desktop study to get a policy recommendation.
Quite right, yeah.
Jörg, I think we should wrap up this show, and then maybe in our next show look a little bit at some of the tools or some of the practical elements in value chain promotion.
Yeah, we should highlight that we're also going to talk to a couple of other people, specialists, both from academia and from development agencies who are involved in value chain analysis and value chain development.
Okay, so that's it then for today. We'd like to remind our listeners that you can place comments on our website at www.ledcast.net.
And really, please do that. I mean, we have been pleading this for quite some time now. We are really, really serious about it. We really appreciate your comments, your feedback, and your suggestions.